I mean, truly, if you are still here at this point, you guys, you are the Hebrews group that have held fast to the end. Congratulations. You get a gold star. Doesn't that feel great? All right, we have to move because I spent a lot of time on that, and I am so happy that we did, though, because it's kind of the kind of stuff that's life-changing, I think, personally. Writing my thesis on Romans 7 was very life-changing and thought-changing for me in terms of Scripture and just personal life, sanctification. I mean, there's hardly anything else that hits closer to home than that. And so I think it's worth our time and our energies, and I sure appreciate you guys being patient and walking through that together. Okay. We're in chapter 8. Let's start speeding up here. We have verse 5, Romans chapter 8, verse 5. For those who, literally it says, who are according to the flesh, they think the things that are according to the flesh. And those who are according to the Spirit, they think the things that are according to the Spirit. He's beginning to bifurcate them. There's two different realms now going on. Now, let me also bring up this so that it doesn't mystify. And I know I've talked a lot about, like, you're now a new creation. The old is gone. The new has come. And you're like, but hold on. Doesn't other passages say that we still have a sin nature? Well, no, we don't have a sin nature, but we do have the flesh. So it's not a nature. Nature is not a good term for it. I understand what people are saying, and I think it's a semantics issue. They want to say we have a sin nature and we have a new nature. No, the new things have come, the old things are gone. That's the nature part. But you have two realms. You have two realms. Your nature now is to be in Christ. You're like, but that's not my habit. Yeah, habits are not necessarily the same thing as your nature. The nature is who you are. Your habits are what you're used to doing. You just need to train your habits to line up with your new nature. That's why you feel the struggle. You still feel the struggle because you're in this body. As long as you're tied to the sin-cursed body, the non-resurrected body, you will always feel the temptation to sin. I'm sorry that that's the case. That's sad. That's the way that it is. You will always feel the temptation to sin. There's always going to be the memory, the experiential memory of, like, really close sin. But you never have to give in. That's what's wonderful. In fact, you have the power to resist. Unlike the disciples in the Garden of Gethsemane, whose spirit was willing but their flesh was weak. That's the Old Testament believer. That's Romans 7. The New Testament believer, the Christian, is what Galatians 5 talks about, where when you are... Well, actually, let's turn over there because this is such an important verse. Galatians chapter 5, verse 16 specifically. Galatians 5, verse 16. You need to know this promise. You should have this, like, ingrained in your brain so well that if I came and woke you up at 3 in the morning, you would be like, I'm quoting this verse. Walk by the Spirit, and you will certainly not carry out the desire of the flesh. Yes? Walk by the Spirit, and you certainly will not carry out the desire of the flesh. Ume, double negative in Greek. He can hardly get, in this kind of construction, he actually can't get any more emphatic than that. Ume. There is obviously me genoita, but that doesn't fit the construction. So, in this case, that's as hard, fast as he can go. When you walk in the Spirit, this realm, you are not in the flesh realm. And vice versa. When you're walking in the flesh, you are not walking in the Spirit. They are two mutually exclusive realms. The new covenant has made a new circumstance where those realms are completely divorced from one another. And we should be thankful for that. Because that there's no more mixing. There's no more mixing so that, well, sometimes if I try to walk in the Spirit, I might be walking in the flesh at the same time. That's not possible for Christians. You're either walking in the Spirit or you're not. It's an amazing promise, isn't it? Sanctification is not so much like... I understand what people are saying when they have, like, the charts where they go, you know, they're going up like this over time and you're getting better and better and better. I understand that. That makes sense to me and there's a place for that to a degree. But technically, sanctification is kind of more like this. There's like a line and you're either under the line or you're over the line at any point in time. And the idea of sanctification is not so much like, okay, I'm seeing the upward trajectory, even though there is a case for that. I don't want to disagree with that. The key is that you have more consistency over the line. You're seeing more consistent over the line than you are under the line. That's, I think, a more faithful way of looking at sanctification in the New Testament. Okay, so that's Galatians 5. But back in Romans 8, oh, maybe you had a finger there. If not, sorry, you're going to have to go back and find it again. Romans chapter 8. The mindset of the flesh is death, but the mindset of the spirit is life and peace. For this reason, the mindset of the flesh is hostile toward God, is in enmity with God. And it is not able to submit to the law of God. It is not submitted to the law of God, nor is it able to. There's that word, not able. Now, this is where you gotta, like, this kind of blows the mind. But he's not necessarily talking about just unbelievers here. This is weird. He's talking about anyone who was under the old covenant. So when you were under the old covenant, even if you were a believer, you were not able to submit yourself to the law of God. Got to think more expansively in this. It's not just the unbeliever here. Those who are in the flesh, that would be literally people like King David and King Solomon, and then all of the unbelievers too of their day. Those who are in the flesh, they were not able to ultimately please God. Not in the ultimate sense. But that's not true for you. You are not in the flesh. You are in the spirit. That's your new nature. And then he says, assuming the Spirit of God dwells in you. Right? Of course, assuming that you're saved, right? And if anyone does not have the Spirit of Christ, he is not his, right? He does not belong to him. But if Christ is in you, though the body on the one hand is dead because of sin, on the other hand, the spirit is literally life in you because of justification or because of righteousness. And if the spirit of the one who raised Jesus from the dead dwells in you, the one who raised Christ from the dead will also make alive or bring to life your mortal bodies through his spirit who dwells in you. Okay? And then, this is really important in verse 12 and 13. Therefore then, brothers, we are indebted. The word is literally, we are debtors. We are debtors. We saw that earlier in chapter 1 where Paul is a debtor. I'm trying to pronounce it that way because I feel like I mispronounce that all the time. But Paul's a debtor to the Gentiles, to minister to the Gentiles. Well, we all as Christians are debtors, not to the flesh, to live to the flesh. Because King Flesh does not reign over us anymore. It is the Spirit, by the new covenant grace, that reigns over us. We are indebted to Him. Now look at verse 13. Very important. If you are living according to the flesh, you will what?
Die.
If you're just, and what he's saying there is not just like, well, I, as a Christian, I accidentally walked in the flesh. Oh no, I'm going to die. No, that's not what he's saying. He's saying when you were, that was your only recourse was the flesh. You had no spirit to help you. You will die. And you will need somehow newness of life. And that's why the Old Testament saints, they died, but the sacrifice of Christ worked retroactively for them. But the idea is now under this new economy, if you die without the Spirit, there is no hope for you. There is no hope, not in this economy. Now, if by the Spirit you are putting to death the deeds of the flesh or of the body, you will live. That is really important. There is the measure of what it means to be a Christian, right? You're putting to death the deeds of the flesh. And notice he's using the continuous tense, right? The present tense, right? But you are putting to death the deeds of the body. That means that this is continuous. This is a continual process that's happening in your life. This is something. It's not just something that's looking at a bird's eye view of the whole situation. He really wants to emphasize this is going to be something that's part of the process of your life. You're putting those things to death. It gives you encouragement. That, you know, it's not that we're looking that you have to be perfect. Obviously, that's not the gospel. Christ was perfect on your behalf. But putting to death the deeds of the flesh demonstrates that you are now united with him. You are in him. For as many as are being led by the Spirit of God, verse 14, these are sons of God. There's all this theology that's coming out here. Corporate solidarity, the fact that you have the son of David, the fact that now we're sons, and because he is the son of God, we are now sons of him, and this whole thing is being brought out. But don't have time necessarily to get into all of that. But verse 15, for you did not receive a spirit of slavery again, leading to fear, but you received a spirit of adoption. It's not that you don't necessarily have, not that you're not enslaved to God. He's already talked about the fact that you're a slave to God, but you have not a spirit that leads to fear. There's no more fear, but you have this relational connection now with God the Father and God the Son that when you if you had a father who was a loving, caring father and you displeased him, it was not always just a fearful thing for you, but it was a sad thing for you because you loved your father and you wanted to please him because he really, truly loved and cared for you. That is kind of the idea here with the relationship that we have with God. It's not out of terror, like he's going to disconnect himself from us forever if we do something wrong, but rather he loves us and we have a spirit that is enslaved to him in a good way. We have a good slave-master relationship with him. And it's the kind of relationship that we cry out, Abba Father, Daddy Father, so to speak. This spirit testifies even with our own internal spirit, just our own personal spirit, the spirit that everyone has, whether you're a believer or an unbeliever. This spirit testifies with our spirit that we truly are children of God. And if we're children of God, then we're heirs. That means we inherit the throne, or not the throne, but we inherit, I should say, more of the inheritance of the kingdom, right? We inherit the kingdom. And obviously it gets differentiated when we're talking about land promises and so forth, but we inherit the kingdom. And we are heirs of God in one sense, but also fellow heirs with Christ. There's that corporate unity tied with him. We're fellow heirs with him. Assuming, or indeed, if we suffer together with him so that also we might be glorified. Now he's kind of transitioning. He's giving us a little bit of a more future outlook in what it's like for us as Christians living in this sin-cursed world, longing for the glory. We're longing for the glory. And that unity, you cannot receive the, this is what's so amazing. You cannot receive the glory of Christ until you suffer with him. You know what that is? That basically means you cannot look like Christ's second coming until you look like his first coming. That's what it means to get all of Christ. You don't get part of Christ. You don't just get the shiny temple and the enjoyable heavenly abode. You get also what? The sufferings. That's what it means to get all of Christ. And there's joy in that. There's joy in that because this is tying back in the chiasm chapter 5, but you know you are part of Christ as the Spirit fills your heart with the love of Christ, that you are united with him. When you suffer, you can still rejoice because that suffering leads to endurance, and that endurance leads to proven character, and that proven character leads to hope. Right? You know. You know that you are his. And so just as Christ's life it ends in glory, but it was preceded by suffering, so our life too ends in glory, but must be preceded with suffering. That's how we know. When we suffer for Christ, there's a lot of good evidence that you are in the faith. There are a lot of people that call themselves Christians today that are probably not Christians. They're out there in the world and they're not really allegiant to Christ. Persecution is the best way to really differentiate people. That's how the early church worked. It really helped to remove the fakers. It's a daunting thing to face persecution like that, but the fakers get removed, the church is purified, and when you see people on a massive scale stay with Christ in persecution, the world can't explain that. The world really can't explain that. We'll see individuals, religious zealots, die for their faith. We'll see that all the time in Islam and so forth, right? We'll see that. That happens. It doesn't happen to the every average day Joe in false religions. It only happens in Christianity because you're given a power that no religion can replicate. It's like Pharaoh's magicians. They're trying to replicate something, and then ultimately God's power is just like, I'm going to take that and plus one, plus two, plus ten. And it just wipes them away. It's like, wow. This is the key. Glory and suffering is kind of carry on here through chapter 8 a little bit for us to see this. There's this tension because in verse 18, he says, the sufferings are not worthy to be compared to the glory that is about to be revealed to us. This creation longs for this newness, and it doesn't have it yet. But we have a testament in our heart of something unique that creation doesn't have, that we're tasting. It's a really interesting thing. So when your dog is moaning because he's in pain, he longs for something better. Creation longs, and it really is a personification. It's really speaking to that in a personifying way. But they long for this. If you skip down to verse 22, for we know that all creation groans and is in pain. The word is like birth pain until the present time. This is still happening, Paul says. And we can say today, it's still happening. And it says also in verse 23 that we ourselves are groaning. So you have creation groaning and we're groaning. And guess what? Verse 26, who else is groaning? The Spirit is. The Spirit is groaning for us. I'm going to come back to that in a second. But look at verse 24, this theme of hope. For we were saved in hope. Now, hope which is seen is not really hope. So he's basically saying like, hey, if we're all about hope here, then you can't have your cake and eat it too. You can't have like the thing realized in front of you and say that you're also living a life of hope, because then it's realized and hope is gone. Hope is essential to the Christian life. And Hebrews 11 picks up on that significantly. But that which is seen, who hopes for what he sees? You basically, in getting that same point. But he says, we are hoping for what we have not seen, and through endurance, we eagerly wait for it. We eagerly wait for it. And the question is, what are we eagerly waiting for? What are we eagerly waiting for? We're waiting for a new creation, a kingdom, right? The inheritance, yes? Now the mysterious verse of 26, and we'll tie this together in context. This verse, I think a lot of people actually get this verse partially right, I think. But as funny as it is, it's just hard to put it in context, isn't it? It's like, okay, likewise, also the Spirit intercedes in our weakness, or he helps us in our weakness. For what we should pray, we do not know what is necessary that we should pray. But the Spirit intercedes with unspeakable groanings. The Charismatic Church has really capitalized on this, and I'm not even going to go into that because it's so bad. The hermeneutics are so bad, it's obvious. But the idea here that typically we say, okay, the Spirit intercedes for all of our prayers and helps us. And I think that that's probably true. I think that that's, you might be able to pull that out of this verse. But what I want to do is make sure that we tie it to the context. Tie it to the context. What is the Spirit doing? He's speaking with unspeakable groanings. Groanings that are too deep for words, so to speak. And you have creation groaning and we're groaning. And then the Spirit is groaning. What are we groaning for again? The kingdom, right? The inheritance, the new creation. Yeah. Creation is groaning for the what? The kingdom, the inheritance, right? Yes. What is the Spirit helping us to do? Groan for the kingdom, right? The kingdom, the new creation. This is how the Spirit helps us and intercedes for us. Could it be beyond that? Yeah. I mean, I'm not opposed to that at all. I'm just saying, tie it to the context, and that's the most immediate thing that's coming out. He helps us to groan for a kingdom that we have not yet seen with our own eyes. He helps us to visualize and long for that which we've never even known. That's really cool. Now, the one who searches the hearts, he knows what the mindset of the Spirit is, because he intercedes according to God on behalf of the saints. Now, this is really cool, because he says, we don't know. Follow the train of the words here. This is where, like, when you're doing your Bible study, you find words you see repeated in a text. Like, oh, it's here, it's here, it's here, it's here. And then if you get to know Greek, which I encourage all of you to do, because it's really fun, because then you get to really, like, read it as it was originally written. And Hebrew, too, if you want. And Aramaic, if you want to, because it's all in there as well. But you really see these things stand out because they're all written in the same... you know, conjugation and so forth. You see it. It's like, it's really clear. But he says in verse 26, we don't know what we should pray for, right? We don't know. But this is what's really cool. Follow the train of thought. But verse 28, but what do we know? But what do we know? We do know this. We know that God works all things together for good for those who love him, for those who are called according to his purpose. That we do know. We don't always know what we should pray for. We don't even always know how to pray in the way that really asks for everything that the kingdom will afford to us. But we do know that God works all things together for good. By the way, that's picking up on Genesis 50. I don't think that that's an accident. I think Paul is intentionally thinking of Genesis 50, verse 20. You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. God is in the business... This is just a great principle across the board. God is in the business of turning evil for good. Boy, the glory of God is really on display. Not just the fact that he is good, not just because he champions good, but because he takes evil and turns it to good. Why do you think God allowed sin? I mean, he couldn't have to. Because he's going to show off how he can turn evil for good. That's what he's doing. And that is what that's what he does in Genesis 50. He's turning evil for good. You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. It's a really cool play on words. We could always study Genesis and how, like, that phrase was used earlier by Jacob. And it's like, am I in the place of God? Jacob says to Rachel, I think. I can't give you children. This is God's work. I can't do that. Am I in the place of God? And then Joseph uses those words to his brothers and turns it. And you can see how the book culminates in the beauty that God has been behind the scenes the entire time. He gave the children to Rachel. And he also, Joseph says, am I in the place of God? You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. In other words, yeah, I helped you. Yeah, I helped you in the famine. But take off the mask. I was just a mask. It was God that was doing this whole thing. He was turning the evil for good. I could go more on that. That's such a cool thing. But, verse 29, because, and this is where we get into the aorist tense issue. Because we take all of these as past tenses. And that might be true, but I don't see any reason in the context to actually do that. Because you have to have time indicators in the context to say that. Instead, I would argue that these are axiomatic, meaning that you can put an S on the end and it should work, meaning that these are in principle. This is how it happens. This is what God does. And it actually makes a lot of sense when you argue this. Let me read it to you the way that your translation probably has it. Because those whom he foreknew, past tense, happened in the past, he also predestined to become conformed to the image of his son, so that he might be the firstborn among many brothers. Now also whom he predestined, these also he called, and these whom he called, these also he justified, and these also whom he justified, these he glorified, past tense. And then we got to explain away the past tense there. Well, he hasn't really glorified them yet, but he will someday. And it's kind of like a future-looking past tense, right? Okay, now let's use the aorist the way that it normally and default way should be used. It's axiomatic and in principle. And it would be translated this way. Because those whom he foreknows, see how it's generic and it's in principle, he also what? Predestines them. Not saying like it's happening right now, saying axiomatically, in principle, to become conformed to the image of his son so that he might be the firstborn among many brothers. Now those whom also he predestines, these also he calls, and those whom he calls, these also he justifies, and then those whom he justifies, these also he what? Glorifies, in principle. See that? It alleviates the tension. Now you don't have to try and explain away a past tense future, which is completely contradictory. Okay? Okay, good. Now you can see how he, like, the golden chain of redemption, these are clear. We could go on and on about that. You've probably been taught that. When God chooses someone, they will reach to the very end. It will happen. You will get to glory. Then, a rhetorical question in verse 31. We haven't seen one in a while. Therefore, what will we say to these things? And I think Paul is just basically turning to his audience and saying, hey, ignore, it is a rhetorical question, but kind of, I know we're in this debate with this guy, but just think about this. We as an audience, what will we say to all of these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? Wow, and he's really returning back to all those themes in chapter 5. Again, he's ending the chiasm. He's closing it out. He did not spare his own son. He gave him, that's terminology again, coming from Romans chapter 5. He did not spare his own son. He freely forgave us. Who will bring a charge against God's elect? This is pulling from Isaiah chapter 50. Who is the one who condemns? God is the one who justifies. Who's the one who condemns? Christ Jesus is the one who died, rather is the one who's raised, who is at the right hand of God, who intercedes on our behalf. Who will separate us from the love of Christ? You can hear the Calvinistic theology coming out here, can't you? You cannot be separated from the love of Christ. Tribulation can't separate you. Distress, persecution, famine, nakedness, danger, the sword, you could die. Nothing can separate you from the love of Christ. When you are called by Christ, it will happen. Nothing can separate you. Just as it has been written, and he quotes from Psalm 44 here, on your account, we are being put to death all day long. We were regarded as sheep to be slaughtered. And yet what? We endured. Why? Because you called us and you will finish the job. Verse 37, but in all these things, we more than overwhelmingly conquer through the one who loved us. In other words, we overwhelmingly conquer by means of him. It's because of him. By the way, you can see that love return, the theme of love. That was the theme back in chapter 5, right? The Spirit pours out the love of God into our hearts. The chiasm is coming to a close. For I have become convinced that neither death nor life nor angels nor rulers or things present or things to come or powers or miracles, you could even translate it as, nor height or depth or any other created thing will be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Christ Jesus our... What does it say? Lord. Remember how I was saying how, like, at the end and beginning of every chapter you see, or at least a paragraph, you see Lord, Lord, Lord. This concludes the Lordship theme that Jesus Christ is our representative as Lord. Okay? Now, this is what's really interesting. This is sometimes missed because you enter a new section here, and so you kind of put a little break, and sometimes we forget where he's come from. He says, nothing can separate us from the love of Christ, right? But, chapter 9, I wish I could. Isn't that interesting? That's what Paul says. But I speak the truth. He has to say that because it would almost be like shocking that you would say that. I speak the truth in Christ. I'm not lying. My conscience testifies in me, in the Holy Spirit, that I have great grief and unceasing pain in my heart. That's what it literally says in Greek. I have great grief and an unceasing pain in my heart. Unceasing. It's not ending for Paul. For I wish what? I could be what? Accursed. That's what it literally says, accursed, separated from Christ on behalf of my brothers, my kinsmen, according to the flesh. He's saying, I wish all of the Jews could be saved if I could be sent to destruction. Whoa. He just got done saying nothing can separate us from the love of Christ. but I wish I could, if I could save my brothers. Now, why does he say this? What is he pulling from here? Someone in the Old Testament tried to do this. Can you think of who that was? Someone tried to stand in the place. I thought I heard it. Moses. Good. I almost said Moses chapter 32. Exodus chapter 32. The golden calf incident. Yes? And Moses offers an idea to God. It's so cool because Moses is on the right line of thinking. This is what would need to happen for Israel. But he says, take me instead and spare all of them. Corporate solidarity. Corporate representation. You see that? Moses is showing he's fit to be their leader. I sacrifice for them. That's what a leader does. That's what a commander does in an army. He sacrifices for his troops. He leads them and then does the greatest sacrifice. But God says what? No. Why? Why do you think God said no? Because Moses, you're not fit to be their sacrifice. Right? But who did become the sacrifice? Christ, right? And so Paul knows he's not even going to go there and actually, Lord, here's an idea. What if I sacrifice myself on behalf of my kinsmen and my brethren? He's not going to do that. Why? Because he already knows what? Christ did that. Christ did that. He just wishes and prays that every single Jew of his time would have come to know the Lord. That's what he wants. That is a really high calling, and I would focus on, yes, we want to get there in our sanctification where we could say, I love people so much, I'd be willing to do that. But don't focus on trying to get there. I would argue, just focus on loving people, and you'll naturally get there in time if you grow in your love for people enough. I'm not there, but we can continue to grow in our love for people. That can seem like such a high calling. Like, man, how do you get there where Paul was just wishing that he could be accursed from Christ for people? Focus on loving people. The goal is not necessarily that we get there. The goal is that we love people. You'll grow. You'll grow into that. He calls them Israelites. These are people who have all those blessings they talked about in chapter 3. Like, wait, what's the benefit of being a Jew? Well, you have all these things. You have the covenants. You have the giving of the law. You have the priestly service, the promises of the fathers. And you have all these connections according to the flesh. But he says, it's not as though God's word has failed them. And this is what's so cool. And this is what's blasting, I think, personally, the covenant theology, where, well, the churches have replaced Israel. We don't need to really think about Israel anymore. And the promises have been superseded and they've been reinterpreted. No, they really struggle with Romans 9 through 11. They may not even say that they struggle with it, but the problem is they literally have to do injustice to the terminology of this text and make it say something that it's really not saying. No, God's promises have not failed Israel. Israel is going to be redeemed. And we're going to see that here in a little bit. They are from the seed of Abraham. Verse 7, in Isaac your seed will be called. It's not the children of the flesh, though. It's the children of the promise that he's regarding the seed. And what he's saying is, he's not just saying like, well, we're just all spiritualized now. That's not what he's saying. Be careful what he's saying. He's talking about within physical Israel, there is a remnant of spiritual what? Israel. There's true Israel. It's not like, oh, no, no, we're going to redefine the circle to make it like it's just been spiritual and we are spiritual Israel now as Gentiles. It's not what he's saying. Look very carefully at the text. He's saying within physical Israel, there is a spirit. There always has been. There's been a spiritual Israel, right? And he uses this to prove that not every physical Israelite is legit. And he's like, you just need to go. It's like you see multiple examples in Genesis alone. You go and see Abraham. Okay, he was legit. Okay, cool. But then Abraham didn't just have Isaac. Who else did he have? Ishmael. And Ishmael was circumcised. So he must be part of Israel, right? No, he wasn't. Everybody knows that. In fact, his descendants really hate Israel today. A lot. Then he talks about, and this is one of the coolest themes. He's not just pulling this one out of thin air. This one's like written in the fabric of the Old Testament. But you have Jacob and Esau. I've got to double check if I'm... Oh, good. I did record. Okay. Sorry. Just need to double check that before. Jacob and Esau, they're twins. Twins should look the same. They sound the same. They even smell the same, probably. Right? I'm a twin. I know. I'm speak from experience. All right? The point is that what should God be doing with twins? He should be choosing what? If we look at it from a human point of view, he should choose both of them the same, right? Because they look the same. They act the same. They sound the same. But what does he do? He says, I've loved who? Jacob and hated Esau. Hating Esau is not because, like, I just hate you because I hate you and you're just terrible. It's not that. Hate and love in the Old Testament was, hate is the absence of the primary love. That's what hate is. It's always relative. It's not like, I despise you and I loathe you. That's not what he's talking about. It's saying, at least in this context, he's saying, I love Jacob so much that it will look like hatred when they turn against Israel. And it will actually be turning against Edom and the whole thing. Right? But Jacob I love. Esau I have hated. That's what he says there in chapter 9, verse 13. And then the rhetorical question comes, because this really gets under the skin of the Jew. Because he's basically saying, therefore, what shall we say? So he turns to his audience. He says, hey, audience, what should we say to the imaginary Jew? Because the imaginary Jew is going to ask this question. There's not unrighteousness then with God, is there? Because what you're saying, Paul, is that God is choosing someone over someone else before they were even born. He chose. He said to Rebekah, the older will serve the younger. That was promised before they were even born. So, doesn't that make God unjust? Like, he didn't even consider their deeds? Okay, now we're getting some deep waters here with choosing. This is where Paul goes deep with election. You ready? Buckle your seatbelts and put your crash helmets on. We're going to jump into this. For he says to Moses, I will have mercy upon whom I have mercy. I'll have compassion upon whom I have compassion. Notice the emphasis is on mercy here. Not just I choose whom I choose and blah, you know, that kind of thing. There is an implication here already that everyone deserves what? Destruction. Everyone deserves destruction. That's already implied. Therefore, then, it's not based upon the one who wants it or who wills it, nor upon the one who runs, but upon God who has mercy. God is the ultimate one who chooses to give mercy to whomever he desires. For the scripture says to Pharaoh, so Pharaoh is a great example. Hey, I demonstrated my power in you. I raised you up so that I would demonstrate my power in you and so that my name might be proclaimed throughout the whole earth. In other words, verse 18, he has mercy on whom he desires and he hardens whom he desires. Oh, I struggled with this when I was in college. I was wrestling through this. I'm like, what is this going? Like, okay, so basically God just lines people up. This is what I thought was happening. I was like, is this what the Bible's saying? People, it's like when you're picking a sports team, when you're in a kickball game and you're at school and you line up all your friends up against a wall and you got two people and they're like picking teams, like, you're on my team and you're on my, and it's like God is like lining up everyone, is like, you come on my team and you go to destruction, you come on my team, and it's like, you know, it's like, what, this is so unfair, like I didn't even get a chance. But it makes it sound like that, right? Because he did this before they were what?
Born.
Oh man, that does make it a little hard. And then on top of that, he hardens people. So he makes them go quicker to destruction. Ah, that's hard. Couple things. One, hardening. And we see this in Exodus very clearly with Pharaoh. Hardening is not divorced from that person's will. It's never divorced from the person's will. When you put the carrot in front of the rabbit, so to speak, the rabbit goes after the carrot. Why? Well, I put the carrot there, so I led him down that road, right? But the rabbit, what? He loves the carrot. God did not put Pharaoh in situations so that he would sin. I want you to sin. No, he never did that. He put Pharaoh in those situations to reveal what Pharaoh wanted the most. And that led him further down the road of a hardness of heart. Because we see how It says God hardened Pharaoh's heart, but it also says Pharaoh hardened his heart. Yes? There is an interplay going on here where God puts Pharaoh in circumstances so that Pharaoh wants even more to do those things. That's what the hardening is. Secondly, this text is not assuming that people are neutral. It's not the situation of, well, everyone's lined up against a wall, and everyone's neutral, everyone's a blank slate. That's not true, because the emphasis is on the word mercy, which assumes what? Sin. That's not, now, of course, that's not refuting the idea that there is a choosing before they were born, though, before they had any deeds of good and bad. That's what it says earlier, right? But the issue is God is choosing people for mercy before they are born. For destruction, everybody earns it. You see it? See the difference? God is choosing people for salvation before they've done anything good or bad. That's what the text says. What it also says is that people earn their way to what? Destruction. That's very important. Hopefully that helps to alleviate that tension for you. It does for me. It completely alleviates it. But you have to really think carefully. In other words, I'm not a big proponent of double predestination. That's a terminology where it's like he's independently choosing people for heaven and choosing people for hell, and it's irregardless of anything that they've done. That doesn't make any sense scripturally. Rather, what's happening is he's choosing people for heaven, and then everyone else is choosing their way to hell. Does that make sense? And of course, by default, because they're not chosen by God to go to heaven, they are left to their devices to do what they can do. So, yeah.
Does that mess with God's sovereignty?
No. I don't think so. Yeah. Or do you, maybe in a way, are you thinking maybe it does in some way? Or
I don't know. It just seems kind of passive. To be like, yeah, everybody was already doing this, but I just plucked some people out of the, you know,
right,
lake they were drowning in.
Right. Man is always responsible, and it's very clear even in the book of Proverbs, the mind of a man plans his way, and it talks about how the man owns and is responsible for his thoughts. That's not in any way downgrading God's sovereignty, because he's in total control over all of that. In any destination of where anyone goes, he's in total control over that. If we believe that man goes to destruction irregardless of his deeds, then it tears apart what Romans 2 talked about, that he judges everyone according to their deeds, not according to his what? Choice. I would argue it's not tearing anywhere his sovereignty, because he has the capacity and does choose anyone that he wants. It's just that he's not choosing them, and they are choosing destruction. So, but let me know if you have any other questions on that. That's a great question. Yeah. And we're in really deep waters here, right? So this is fun. Yeah, Brandon, yeah.
Peter Sammons covers that real well in his book. Reprobation.
Oh, good. Great. What's it called again?
I believe it's either the sovereignty of God and reprobation, or reprobation and the sovereignty of God.
Oh, good. Perfect. So. Thank you. That's a great resource. Feel free to check that out if you want. Yeah, good. Peter Sammons, Sammons, I think is what it is. Yep. Very good. Okay. All right, good. We'll keep moving. Oh, my goodness, it's 4 o'clock. Okay. This is where the most, I don't know, the question that is probably most troubling to the Jew, I think, is this question in verse 19. Because you're really in the heat of it now with God didn't choose me. You know, you're like, and you'll hear this from unbelievers a lot. Well, what if God didn't choose me? Doesn't that make God unfair? And, you know, what if I'm not elect? You know, and they'll go into all of this as they, like, love their sin and, like, you're not taking responsibility for this? Second person singular, rhetorical, right? Second person singular is rhetorical, talking to the imaginary Jew. You, Mr. Jew, will say to me then, why does he still find fault with me? Because how can I resist his will if he's not elected me? Okay? That's the question. And here he says, verse 20, who are you, O man, who answers back to God? First off, I'm going to establish the fact that God has a right to do whatever he wants. He has full sovereignty to do whatever he wants. It says, will the thing molded say to the molder, why did you make me like this? Why did you make me in this way? Does not the potter have authority over the clay to make from the same lump one vessel for honorable use and one for some kind of common use? But that's not what God didn't just send everyone for dishonorable use. He actually has all people take responsibility for their dishonorable use, and then he chooses people out of that group. People are running as hard and as fast away from God as possible, and God is choosing people out of that group. That's what's happening. They are not static, and they are not neutral. They are independently wanting to do these things of their own voluntary will. And I use that term very specifically because we often use the term free will, and that gets into all kinds of loaded implications. Because free will sounds like we're free from the sovereignty of God, right? And sometimes we say free will, and we don't really mean free will. We don't mean free from the sovereignty of God. What we mean is voluntary will. Voluntary will. Everyone is moving as far away and as fast from God as possible in their voluntary will. They want to do this. God's not forcing them to do this. God's not wanting them to sin. And they are doing this of their own volition. And yet at the same time, he, not of their own volition, comes in and chooses and brings them out so that he regenerates them and makes them followers of God. And that showcases the fact that salvation is by his grace alone and not of any of our volition. Does that make sense? Okay. That's the picture. I was really helped by that at a Resolved conference, actually, when I was in college. And I heard a quote from David Wells. I think Rick Holland was preaching. He quoted it. And it really helped to really reset that picture. I had the whole dodgeball thing in my mind. And I was like, oh, man, we're all neutral. Like, what's going on? And then he quoted David Wells. And it was so good because it was like everyone's running as fast and as hard away from God as possible. And God is plucking people out one by one. And I'm like, that makes sense. That's exactly what Romans 9 is saying. And he did this where it says that verse 22, what if, in other words, God was willing to demonstrate his wrath, to make known his power, to destroy everybody. Instead, though, he bore with much patience vessels of wrath who, and this is where there's a debate on this, have they been prepared for destruction by God? Or is it that they prepare themselves for destruction? It could go either way. I tend to take the they prepared themselves for destruction. It's in the middle voice there. And he did so to make known the riches of his glory upon vessels of mercy. Emphasis on mercy, right? The implication, we deserve destruction. Yeah. Whom he also called, not only from among Jews, but also from Gentiles. The whole focus has been on Jews this point. Because the Jew is like, why? Because what if I want all Israelites to be saved so I can feel safe for myself. So I have kind of that safety net that I don't have to really struggle with actually like believing in the Messiah and running the risk of going to destruction. I want the safety of just, I'm born a Jew and I'm safe. Yay. But Paul's like, you're not safe. You could easily go to destruction. God has selected his Jewish people, certain Jewish people within the larger Jewish framework that are going to be his. And that's really causing all these Jews to feel very insecure. And that's why he knows that they're going to struggle with this. And so he says, but this isn't just something that's happening with Jews only, but also among Gentiles as well, yeah? So then he says, just as he says in Hosea. And this is where covenantalists really get on this, because they're like, ah, see, he's reinterpreting Hosea, because Hosea chapter 1 and 2 is all about Israel, and now he's applying this to the Gentiles. So that means that Hosea, what really was happening in Hosea is that this is the church, right? And that's what's going on. They really interpret it back in. What's going on here? And I talked about this in BTI the other day. He uses the word as. Do you see the word as in your text? It better not be in italics, or else they did a mistake. Okay? Should say as, just as he says in Hosea. That as is telling us that there is a precedent being set. A precedent is being set. That means that something happened in the Old Testament, and this is now working in the same framework today for the Gentiles. But that is not a reinterpretation of the Old Testament. It's showing similarity, just as. Okay? Terminology is so critical, even down to little words like as. It's two words in English, and it's two words in, or sorry, two words. It's two letters in English, and it's two letters in Greek. Very small, but very, very important. And I could do a study with you on when he says just as, or like as, or in this way. They all have this two-letter framework that you can use to show this New Testament use of the Old Testament is not reinterpreting the Old Testament. It is telling you that there's a comparison being made, and that there's a theology that's being applied in a unique way here, in the same way as it was here. And so in other words, what Paul's saying is, the Gentiles are saved in the same way as the Jews. They're saved in the same way. They were not the people of God. That's what Hosea says. And now you what? Are the people of God. Israel, it's really cool. You are my people, Israel. Exodus. And then all of a sudden they sin so bad, he's like, okay, that's it. I'm divorcing you. You're not my people anymore. You're done. But she who is not my people now, I will bring her back and make her my people. I'm bringing Israel back. Well, that sets a precedent, doesn't it? Because if Israel can become, go from not my people to his people, now the Gentiles can do what? They've always not been God's people. Now they have a path forward to be God's people, don't they? Because Israel went before them. Yes? You see the logic of what Paul's saying? The precedent has been set for Israel, and now it's being applied to Gentiles as well. I will call those who are not my people, my people, and she who is not beloved, beloved. It will be in the place which it was said to them, you are not my people. There they shall be called sons of the living God. Isaiah also says this in Isaiah 10, and then also Isaiah 1 in verse 29. Unless the Lord of not Sabbath, it's easy to think that that's what it is. It's in Hebrew, it would be Sabaoth. It means armies. Yeah. Thus, Lord of Sabaoth had left for us a seed. We would be like Sodom. We would have become like Gomorrah. Okay. Then a rhetorical question in verse 30. Therefore, what will we say? What will we say? That Gentiles who were not seeking righteousness, they obtained righteousness. In other words, like those who weren't even looking for it, like, hey, here's a gift. Really? I wasn't even looking for that. Wow. And then Israel, who's pursuing hard, hard, seeking for the gift, they don't get it. You're like, how is that fair? That doesn't make any sense. But see, the point that Paul's bringing up is that they were pursuing it for their own righteousness and not for the righteousness of God. They were doing it in the wrong way from the very beginning. And if they had realized, we can't attain to this, they should have known that. In pursuing it, they of the first people should know, we can't get to this. We can't attain to it. So if we can't attain to it, then that means we need divine enablement and help, just like the Gentiles need a free gift, right? And he says, why? Verse 32, because they did not pursue it from faith. They did it the wrong way. They pursued it from works. They stumbled over the stumbling stone. And this, of course, pulls from Isaiah, where, and this is actually throughout the whole Testament, where you see the stone of Israel. Going back to Genesis 49, actually, the stone of Israel, he is actually, the stone of Israel, who's supposed to be a refuge and a rock, has become a stumbling stone for Israel, sadly. That shouldn't be the case. But there are those who trust in him and who believe in him, and they will not be disappointed because they will have a refuge to hold on to. Okay? And then chapter 10, we see Paul really bringing out his heart again, just as he did in the beginning of chapter 9. I love my brothers. He says, brethren, talking to his audience, listen, let me just pull aside and just say this. He's saying, my desire, the desire of my heart, the eagerness of my heart is, and the petition that I have to God is for their salvation. I want them to be saved. And this is very interesting. He says, I testify about them that they have a zeal for God. I mean, they really are passionate about God. Don't take that away, because sometimes we'll be like, well, anyone who's not a Christian, right, who's in a false religion, they don't really have a passion for God. No, they do. They do have a passion for God. They just don't do it in the way that God has proclaimed, right? It makes it a little bit more of a daunting thing. Just because you have passion, just because you have zeal for God, does not mean you're saved. It does not mean you're saved. Jews have a passion for God. I dare say sometimes they even emulate more of a passion for God than Christians do, because they actually respect the word of God so much that they will kiss their scriptures. We don't do that. Now, again, I'm not saying that you should do that or that you have to do that to emulate your desire for God. But what I am saying is that they have a legitimate zeal for God. It is legit, but is not according to what? What does it say? Knowledge, right? There's that word again I mentioned yesterday. It's epigenosis. It's not gnosis. It's the word recognition. It means to be able to discern truth, to discern the knowledge correctly. In other words, they have a zeal for God, but it's not in a way that can recognize the truth, that can discern the truth. For not knowing about God's righteousness, and that kind of has more of an idea of, it's not just like knowledge, like data, like I didn't know, but it's like literally not really being acquainted and familiar and really adopting and engaging with this knowledge of God's righteousness. They refuse it, in other words. And seeking to make their own righteousness stand or make that established, they did not submit themselves to the righteousness of God. And who is the righteousness of God? The Messiah. It's their Messiah. In other words, and this is what Jews struggle with today, this is really sad. They really struggle with someone else fulfilling it for them. It's a humiliating thing to know we failed as a nation. Orthodox Jews today who are not faithful to Christianity, but are faithful to Orthodox Judaism, they really struggle with Jesus came and basically told us, you all failed. And I stepped in and did what you couldn't do. The righteousness of God is Jesus on their behalf. And they cannot stomach that because they've put their hope in their own righteousness. I can do this. I can do this. We as Israel can do this. And they have to humble themselves as everyone does before the cross and say, I couldn't do this. I can't do this. Okay? And then this wonderful verse that we should know pretty well. For Christ is the what?
The end of the law.
The end of the law. For righteousness to everyone who believes. I would argue it's the fulfillment. He's the fulfillment of the law. He's the fulfillment of the law. He says in verse 5, Moses writes in the law that if you're going to live by the law, you got to abide by all of it. I'm paraphrasing. You got to abide by all of it. If you're going to get to heaven under the law, you got to abide by all of it. Sounds like Romans chapter 2, right? When he says, he will grant to you eternal life if you endure in doing good, right? In theory, if you did that. Okay, so if you want to live by the law, you got to live by all of it. You got to complete the whole thing. That's the righteousness that comes from the law. That's self-righteousness that you can do on your own. But he says that's not how the righteousness comes from Christ. Righteousness that comes from Christ must believe in him and depend upon him for your righteousness. So he says, and quotes from Deuteronomy, 30 really, but he says, do not say in your heart, who will ascend into heaven, that is to bring Christ down, or who will descend into the abyss, that is to bring Christ up from the dead. But what does it say? The word is near you, in your mouth and in your heart. That is the word of faith that we are preaching. Here again is another great example where covenantalists will say, see, they reinterpreted the Old Testament. Because this is not talking about Christ in the gospel in Deuteronomy 30. It's talking about, hey, here's the law of Moses. And the law is, now we just saw this a little bit earlier. The law is near you. It's in your mouth. It's in your heart. It's not too far. It's not too marvelous. I think that was the term. It's not too marvelous. It's not too wonderful for you to understand. It's clear. It's been codified. It's something you can understand. You don't need to go across the ocean to go find it. It's been given to you right on your lap. It's not something you need to go into heaven and ask God for it as though it's some huge mystery. No, it's been clearly communicated to you, and therefore it's in your mouth and in your heart so that you might do it. So then why does he apply it to the gospel? It's like, that's weird. Why are you doing that? It sounds like you're reinterpreting Deuteronomy. It's not, because what does he say at the beginning of verse 6? He says, the righteousness that comes from faith speaks what? What does it say? Speaks in this way. The word in Greek is houtos, and it has the os ending, which is the like comparison. There it is. It's saying, in other words, the law set a precedent for the gospel. Just as the law, was codified and clear to understand, so is the gospel. It's been brought right to your laps. And in fact, Jesus Christ is the bridge between the law and the gospel, because the law is pointing us to him, right? So Jesus Christ is showing us how the precedent can go from law to the gospel. It's incredible. That's why he's using it this way. He's not saying that's what Deuteronomy meant. He's saying, notice how the gospel works in the same way as the law did. It's really neat. Okay? That if you confess with your mouth Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. And lots going on there as well, but we just need to keep moving forward. And with the heart a person believes, resulting in righteousness, and with the mouth he confesses, resulting in salvation. He's actually pulling from the quote there of the word is near you in your mouth and in your heart. He's using those terms to say, if you believe with your heart and you confess with your mouth, you will be saved. So he's pulling from Deuteronomy there as well. I wish I could unpack that more. We could literally spend an hour on that just talking about how that unfolds, but it's really cool. And then he says, in verse 11, he quotes from Isaiah 28 and says, he basically is quoting this again, the one who believes in him will not be put to shame. And he says, and this isn't just for the Jew. I know I'm talking about Jews, but this works for the Greek, for the Gentile as well. He is Lord over all. You see that in verse 12? He is Lord over all, abounding in riches to all who call upon him. Do you see that in the text? That's why in this section I call it, and you may remember this from the outline that I gave you earlier, but Romans 9 through Romans 11 is the section of God's, the gospel fulfills God's promise to be God over all. That's what Romans 9 through 11 is ultimately about. Yes, it is about the Jews. Yes, it is about the Jews and the promise of God to bring the Jews back. But it is really in a context of, I want to be God of Jews and Gentiles, and I will fulfill my promises to both of them. Okay? And that is why he quotes from Joel chapter 2, where everyone who calls upon the name of the Lord will be saved. That's just comprehensive. It doesn't matter if you're Jew or Gentile. Everyone who calls upon the Lord will be saved. Verse 14, how then will they call upon him whom they've not believed? In other words, you got to believe in him in order to call upon him. And how will they believe on him in whom they have not heard? So you've got to hear about him. And how will they hear without a preacher? So you've got to have someone tell you about this in order to hear it. And how will they preach unless they're sent? So you've got to have people sent out to tell people about this message. This message is a message that has to be carried by word of mouth. That's the only way that people are going to believe. That's the only way that people are going to be saved. And so he said, just as it has been written, how beautiful are the feet of those who bring of good news of good things. But he says in Isaiah 53, remember in Isaiah 53:1, not everyone believed the report. Not everyone obeyed the gospel. Lord, who has believed our report? To whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he grew up before him like a tender shoot, right? You remember that, mm-hmm. Right? Who has believed among Israel? Who among Israel has believed these things? And by implication, he's applying this to everyone, because he just got done saying, everyone who calls upon the name of the Lord will be saved. So let's send out preachers to everyone so they might call upon the name of the Lord, right? This is to the Gentiles. So, in other words, Isaiah 53, Lord, who has believed our report? Yeah, that's true. That's both for Israel and for the Gentiles. We want people to believe, but Israel, especially Israel, is not believing. Not all of them are. And so he says, well, faith comes from hearing. That's how it's going to have to happen. And hearing comes by the word of Christ. And I want to mention that word there for word of Christ is not the logos word that you hear like in the beginning was the word logos and the word was with God and the word was God. This is the spoken word of Christ. It's really important in this context because he's trying to convey this needs to be communicated by word of mouth. And then in verse 18 he says, but I'm saying they did not listen, or they did not hear, did they? In other words, he's saying they didn't hear about the word of Christ, did they? They're not accountable to this, did they? And then he quotes Psalm 19. Their line has gone out into all the world, or their utterance, it could be that translated as well, their words into the uttermost parts of the inhabited earth. And this is really interesting, and I'm going to leave you on a mystery on this one because I might end up talking about this tomorrow in BTI, so I welcome you to that. And I don't want to give it away, but this is interesting because why is he quoting Psalm 19, which is all about creation, where it's like creation is proclaiming the glory of God, and then he's applying it to the gospel, and he doesn't use a just as or like principle here. It's like, oh, this is kind of interesting. So I'll leave that one for you to chew on, because that one's a toughie. That one's a real toughie. But then in verse 19, he says, Israel didn't know about this, did they? Yes, they did. Deuteronomy 32, they did. Isaiah 65, Isaiah even daringly talks about this, about how I was basically found by those who did not ask for me. In other words, that Gentiles would become part of God's plan. And then verse 21, he says about Israel, I stretched out my hands to a disobedient, obstinate people all day long. I do this all the time, and they're still not listening to me. Israel is not believing. So Israel has known for a long time that they are rejecting God. Okay? And that brings us to the end of chapter 10, and I want to take a break, and then we're going to have to blast through the rest of Romans somehow. And I don't know how, but we're going to do something about that, okay? So let's go ahead and take a 10-minute break, and then we'll come back around 4:35.